So I started writing her letters. I wrote a little bit every day. And then after a while, they actually became stories about our interchanges, where she would come and visit me, and then I would record afterwards or write down afterwards what it was that we had done and things we had shared. And I used to call them letters to my Sarah.
One of the last gifts left to us by the late Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair is his memoir. And it was the love for his granddaughter that made it possible.
When my granddaughter, Nemesia Nivance, was born, just before that, about a year before that, I had suffered a minor stroke. And I remember thinking that I may not be around when she grows up. I may not be around to give her the advice that a Muslim needs to give to his granddaughter. She may have questions that only I can answer. She doesn't know about my family. She doesn't know about my grandmother, my grandfather. And so I thought, I'm going to start writing things down for her.
Those letters would go on to encapsulate four questions. Where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? Who am I?
I realized this book is a gift to me, but also a gift to Canada, not just Indigenous peoples, but to non-Indigenous peoples too, for us to learn. It's really something that he gave me, and then now it's to the nation.
Danse, Anin, Buju, hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. The late Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair had many roles. To Sarah Fontaine Sinclair, he was a Musham, a storyteller, a teacher, and someone who dressed up as Shrek at Halloween.
He showed us, especially the younger people in our family, how to be really beautiful and powerful leaders. He always taught us that through a lot of humor.
Sarah guides us in a tribute to one of the most significant Indigenous leaders of our time, through the eyes of a granddaughter. Plus, Stephanie Scott worked alongside Murray during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
For those that have seen him as this iconic figure in Canada and the world, he's also very human. And although he had his traditions and support, there were tears.
And the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry was a moment of hard truth for Murray and for Manitoba. Chief Justice Glenn Joyel says it set into motion this country's path to reconciliation.
First of all, if there wasn't Murray Sinclair, there might not have been an AJI. If there wasn't an AJI, there might not have been a TRC. If there wasn't a TRC, there might not have been an inquiry into missing, murdered women and girls.
The Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair passed on November 4th of this year at the age of 73. Today, we remember and honor the legacy of Mazina Gizik Iban.
He was just a kid, likely more inclined to checking car doors to see if they were unlocked than robbing someone.
That's Murray Sinclair, or Mazina Gizik Iban, reading from his memoir, Who We Are, Four Questions for a Life and a Nation. One day, he was almost robbed by a kid who a few weeks earlier had stood in his courtroom. He had been arrested after running away from his foster home.
I didn't expect to see him again, but here he was.
It was 1988. Murray was just appointed Associate Chief Judge of the Manitoba Provincial Court, only the second Indigenous person to be appointed to the bench in Canada and the first in Manitoba. In his memoir, Murray writes that the would-be robber ended up in a hotel room. Alone and hungry, the boy waited for his social worker to drop off some money for food. But she was always late, so he went looking for money elsewhere and found Murray.
"Ask me to borrow it," I said to him. "What?" "Ask me to lend you $10, I repeated. "I can't pay you back." "Don't worry about that. Ask me. Can I borrow $10? I dug in my pocket and took out what I had. "Here's 40. "How will I pay you back?" "Don't worry about it. Just promise me you'll try to stay out of trouble."
Murray asked the young man for one more thing: go back to school. Education got us into this mess, and education will get us out of it. It was one of Murray's most well-known sayings. He fiercely believed that education was the key for Indigenous people to change their lives and for non-Indigenous people to change their minds. But he recognized that for those who suffered trauma in residential schools, education was a challenge. And so was educating Canada about those difficult truths. Nonetheless, Murray dedicated his life to that challenge for future generations and for a scared kid who tried to rob him.
I hope that young man made it. He deserved to. And if he did, I am glad I had a small hand in it. I hope he knows that the gift he gave me is a beautiful one, because that young man could have also been me.
Murray Sinclair shared many such stories in his memoir, stories that offer lessons, lessons that started out as letters to his granddaughter, Sarah Fontaine Sinclair. Now a music student at the University of Ottawa, Sarah grew up listening to her Mushum tell her stories about life, ceremony, and family. But she also remembers a Mushum who loved rock and roll, motorcycles, and bad dad jokes. Sarah, welcome to Unreserved.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. It's an honor. And please let me just start by extending our entire team's condolences for your loss.
Thank you.
Just know that all of Indian Country is there with you, sharing in your grief.
Thank you.
Now, never have I ever started an interview this way, but I understand your Mushum loved sharing knock-knock jokes.
Yes. I was looking through some of our texts the other day, and almost all of our conversations either had to do with him teasing me about music or him sending me knock-knock jokes. It was like a daily thing that he would send me.
Can you share your best worst one?
Yes. I have some on my phone. He loved elephant ones. Those were his favorite because he loved elephants so much. And one of my favorites was, where does an elephant keep his spare tire?
Where?
In their trunk.
Groaner.
I know.
Those are really good dad jokes. Yeah. How did this routine of sending knock-knock jokes and terrible dad jokes begin with you and him?
It really happened as long as I remembered. Like, a lot of what we do in our family is very playful teasing. It's how we show our love a lot. And my Mushum was just a great example of it. He loved making me laugh. He always taught me that laughter is like the best medicine. One day I asked him, Mushum, where do you get all of these knock-knock jokes? And he just said, they're Mushumisms.
What are some of the, you know, favorite memories that you hold close to you now about your Mushum?
Well, the relationship that I had with him was very based in stories. He would always be teaching me teachings through stories. Some of my favorite ones was he would tell me these Nanabush stories, always on car rides or when I was at his house, and he would always be telling them in these really like animated voices, and I always remember feeling so engaged with these stories. And then suddenly I'd hear snoring and I'd be like, oh my gosh, Mushum fell asleep because of how animated these stories were that he would tell me. So then I'd have to go and get my kukum, my grandmother, to come and wake him up. But those were some of my favorite memories with him, just learning about these teachings through these really funny stories that he'd tell me.
Oh, that would be so great to hear Murray, you know, doing all the voices and acting it out. I'm having a problem picturing it, though. Can you describe that scene for me, please?
Of acting stuff out?
Yes.
Well, it would depend on where we, if we were on the couch, he would start off by like sitting down and he'd be like, okay, Sarah, I'm going to tell you a very sacred story. He'd be telling me the scenes and he'd be describing the nature around. And then when he would get to a really funny section, he'd have this like crooked smile on his face and then he'd start doing like these voices like really high-pitched if it was like a bird or something, and then really low-pitched if it was like a porcupine or like a donkey or something that he was talking about. So he had all these different voices and very big hand gestures.
I love it. love it. Your Moshe Murray Sinclair released a memoir earlier this year, Who We Are, Four Questions for a Life and a Nation. What do you know about how that memoir began?
What I know about it is that he decided that he wanted to write these letters to me so that if he were to pass away before he could share on all of the stories of his past, that I could have access to them. So that's where the idea started, and then it blossomed into him wanting to write a book when I became older. Those letters were for me, but also a gift to Canada, which I find really beautiful.
It is beautiful, a beautiful gift. But how does it feel to know that memoir could have been called Letters to Sarah?
He was talking about that title with me before, and it would have been really touching. But I think the four questions is a really good way that he framed it. He always made sure that I knew how to answer those questions from a very young age. I remember him always sharing me stories of like where my family came from and who I am as an Anishinaabe woman. He'd tell me the story of my name. I have an Anishinaabe name, which is Nimiji Nivekwe. It means the light that dances on the water woman. So I've always been really connected to the water as an Anishinaabe woman, and I feel really connected to the earth, and that's kind of the teaching of my name.
Oh, that's beautiful. And how does it help you answer those four questions? Where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? And who am I?
For me, where I come from is grounded in that name. One of my purposes is to take care of the water, and water is where we all come from. We all live in water for the first few months that we're going in our mother's bellies. Mm-hmm. So that's where I come from. But I also come from a family of very strong leaders, like my mushum and like my father and like my mother. I was always told that being a leader is important, but finding your way to be a leader is the most important, whether it's in a gentle and kind way or whether it's being outspoken and public speaking or just showing people leadership through actions. So that's where I say I come from. The next one is where I'm going, right?
Where am I going? Yes.
Where am I going? Where I'm going, it's hard for me to say, but that name kind of dictates that I must look towards the earth. I must continue my work towards advocating for the earth. I've done a lot of climate advocacy, and I find that where I'm going is also in music too. I share that love of music with my mushum. Mm-hmm. He loved AC/DC and country and rock and roll. Those are some of his favorites.
Absolutely.
he loved Pink Floyd too. And so I'm currently studying music in university, and I feel really connected to him in that way. Like, we would always be exchanging songs. It used to be, when I was a child, we connected through stories, and then when I was older, we connected through songs, which is really beautiful and powerful. And then, why am I here? I feel that I'm here to bring a lot of light. As my name says, the light that dances on the water, I try to bring a lot of happiness and joy wherever I go. Sometimes it's hard when I'm getting up in the morning and I'm a little grumpy. I haven't had my matcha latte.
I hear you.
Yeah. But I find that my role is to bring a lot of light to people's lives, and I try my best to do that. And then, who am I? My mushum always says that you don't really know that question, that you don't really know the full answer to that question until you pass away. Right before you pass away, you kind of can answer that because you look at the entirety of your life and see what you've done throughout your life. But right now, what I feel that I am is a daughter. I'm a niece. I'm also a cousin. I'm a friend. I'm a climate and social justice activist. I'm a granddaughter. And I'm someone who loves the earth and loves animals and wants to dedicate my life towards advocating for that too. So that's who I... Oh, I'm also a musician. Almost missed that one.
Almost missed that.
But yeah, that's who I am, I feel right now.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. We'll be back with my guest, Sarah Fontaine Sinclair, later in the show. Sarah is the granddaughter of the late Marie Sinclair.
It's never been
the legal system per se that was wrong, I thought, and I believe it was the people, how the people within and who used and ran and controlled and manipulated that system, how they did that to the detriment of Indian people.
Murray Sinclair started law school at the University of Manitoba in 1976. In his second year, he won the A.J. Christie Prize, awarded to the top student in litigation. Despite the promising start, Murray became so disillusioned, he nearly quit.
There are hurdles for Native people within the justice system, there's no question of that. I've met them, I've seen them, I've heard about them, and my clients have certainly been confronted by them to this point in time. And to the extent that my being a judge helps those hurdles to be removed, then I hope I can do that.
In 1988, he got his chance. He was appointed the first Indigenous judge in Manitoba. There wasn't much time to celebrate, though. Later that same year, tragedy would rock the community.
On March 9th of 1988, Constable Robert Cross of the Winnipeg Police was on the hunt for a Native car thief. Somehow, he accosted the innocent Native leader, J.J. Harper. Somehow, Harper was shot in a struggle.
Harper's killing and the 1971 murder of Helen Betty Osborne prompted the Aboriginal Justice Inquiry. The young Cree nursing student was brutally murdered in the Paw, Manitoba. Her death would remain unsolved for years. The AJI, commissioned by the government of Manitoba, examined the two deaths and the relationship between Indigenous people and the justice system. In Osborne's case, the AJI would uncover a conspiracy of silence. It found that the community, including a court sheriff, withheld information about who was involved in her death. It took 16 years for someone to be charged in her murder.
It made me think about many of the stories that I had read about the civil rights movement and the racism in southern states and the racism in southern cities and towns, and the fact that, you know, local officials would be well aware of what was going on, and you know, you almost kind of expected to start hearing stories about hooded people driving around the Paw, hunting down Indigenous guys and Indigenous families.
The Aboriginal Justice Inquiry would go on for 3 years. Then Associate Chief Judge Sinclair would lead it alongside Associate Chief Justice A.C. Hamilton. The final report's 296 recommendations were based on a key finding: systemic racism within Manitoba's justice system. Manitoba Chief Justice Glenn Joyelle was a colleague and friend of Murray's. He remembers how those findings landed within the legal community of the time.
Many people were shocked by it. Many people, remember the first time I heard the phrase systemic discrimination coming from that inquiry, I myself was uncomfortable with it, not because I haven't come to understand it and agree with it. I don't think too many people since then have not understood what systemic discrimination means in the context of the justice system and what Murray and Justice Hamilton were trying to do. Back then, it was still, and we're not talking a long time ago, it was still shocking for people. Mm. So people had to kind of absorb what it was he was trying to do, and then absorb what it was that he recommended, that they recommended, in terms of some pretty sweeping changes. One of the things they recommended were case flow management systems by which cases would more quickly and efficiently be dealt with for what is a disproportionate number of Indigenous litigants and accused persons in the system. It's a small thing, but you know, we ought not to forget that that came initially from the AJI. So let me just make this point. If there wasn't the AJI, first of all, if there wasn't Murray Sinclair, there might not have been an AJI. If there wasn't an AJI, there might not have been a TRC. If there wasn't a TRC, there might not have been an inquiry into missing murdered women and girls. And I'm not sure that the conversation about reconciliation would have occurred as quickly as it did.
Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that a little bit more for me? As you said, the inquiry revealed systemic racism within the justice system, a lot of difficult truths. Indigenous people from all over Manitoba, from south to north, were sharing their own experiences in the justice system. What stood out for you at the time when, as somebody who was working within this system, what was it that you were most uncomfortable with?
Well, I wasn't shocked in the sense that we knew that there was an inequity with respect to how we were able to address, again, what I repeat, was a disproportionate presence in the justice system of Indigenous Manitobans. Mm-hmm. So we knew that something was wrong in terms of how we weren't able to effectively deal with what was a problem. It was a human tragedy, a human problem, whether it was in criminal justice system or the child welfare, child protection system. I think we were all shocked to realize that when you put it all together and you looked at the way the policing system worked, corrections, you looked at the way the courts operated, the way we dispensed justice wasn't always appreciative of the lived experience that those Indigenous Manitobans had. And in that sense, didn't bring, for some, the type of requisite impartiality that was required. Mm-hmm. And in some instances, it was worse than that. I've recently been involved in some wrongful conviction cases where the wrongful convictions actually can be connected in some ways to predispositions by not just police officers, but court workers and the justice system generally.
There has been some bigger picture changes made, like GLADU, for example, allowing culture and elders and so on, sweat lodges, into the jail system. But at the end of the day, the inquiry did make 296 recommendations. And in several interviews, Murray has said that he didn't expect many of those to be fulfilled in his lifetime, in fact. Because of the opinion or the belief or whatever you want to call it from Canadians that Indigenous people come from, quote, a violent, inferior, savage culture and therefore are not worth saving, end quote. How did you see that realization impact Murray and affect him? Was it the thing that sent him on this trajectory that you spoke to earlier, do you think?
I mean, Murray was an interesting combination of realist and idealist. Mm-hmm. I think he realized that he was working within a system that would probably be slow to change. And it was interesting that you just said that, because I never heard him sort of acknowledge or even resign himself to the fact that many of his recommendations wouldn't have been realized in his life. I'm not surprised he said that, but I think that's an indication of what he realistically knew he would be facing and what the people who wanted to work for improvements for Indigenous Manitobans would be facing. Despite the fact that he was realistic and he understood that he would be meeting with some resistance, he did not want to sort of sit back and not play the role that he may have been destined to play. I think, you know, important, momentous figures like Murray, they have to be realistic about maybe how much they're actually going to accomplish, but they have to be idealistic enough to know how much they also may accomplish. I never saw him despair. I always found him to be uplifting and positive. That's why it was always interesting to talk to him. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't want to just sort of, as they say, trash institutions for the purpose of trashing institutions. He had in his mind's eye a vision of justice and a vision of fairness that I think drove him, and he understood that that was a vision that would be realized, even if it was going to be a kind of a gradual realization through education, through mentorship, through generous listening. I mean, he was a great listener. What he did during the AJI and then later with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was masterful in terms of the act of listening. Not all of us like to listen. We say we want to listen, but we often also want to talk. Murray certainly could share his views, but he didn't pontificate, and he was always willing to listen to what it was that the person with whom he was talking may need to have known or may need to have learned, and then he would begin from there. That's my memory of Murray, and that's certainly why I see him as interesting combination of realist and idealist, as someone who played such a momentous role in shaping the national conversation.
Chief Justice Joyelle, thank you so much for your time today and remembering Murray with me.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
That is Chief Justice of the Court of King's Bench of Manitoba, Glenn Joyelle. He first met Murray Sinclair in the 1990s as a colleague on the provincial court. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we are remembering the Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair.
where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? And who am I?
Those are four fundamental questions he asked of himself, his family, and his country. And they're questions that his granddaughter and my guest, Sarah Fontaine Sinclair, grew up learning to answer. Earlier in the show, she told us how she would answer those questions for herself. Here's how she answered them about her musha.
Yeah, I was thinking about these quite a bit. Where he comes from is a little bit still hazy to me. I don't know his childhood as much as him being a Mushum, but I know that he came from Little Pegwas First Nation, and he was raised by a lot of really strong women when he was younger. He was raised by these aunties that he would call the big aunties because they had these big personalities and would tell him do a lot of scolding, but in a very gentle and loving way. And he grew up with a lot of racism in his childhood, mm-hmm. which I think propelled him in his later years to do all the stuff that he did. He learned about the injustices from a very young age. He went to public school. He always tried to mention that he was named Athlete of the Year. He was very proud of that. And he was also very proud that he was his class valedictorian. And he was very proud of me when I became my class valedictorian. So I share that with him, too. I'm sure I'll share that in all of my bios throughout my life.
Yeah.
Like he did.
And what year was he Athlete of the Year?
I'm actually not certain. I would have to look that up. But
it was some time ago, though.
It was some time ago. It was in high school for him. So it was. He was still very proud of that, even in his last years of his life.
And what about where am I going?
Where he's going? Well, throughout his entire life, he went on a journey, a very hard one, mm-hmm. Of teaching the nation, of doing a lot of educating. Educating was one of his passions. Even though he wasn't a teacher, he believed that education was really powerful, and he passed on that teaching to me, that educating people is the only way that this country can advance. And if we're doing it in a very open and honest way, that's the best way of educating people, with a lot of kindness and respect, like mutually. But where he's going now is a very beautiful place. We have teachings in our culture that they go towards a spirit world full of beauty, where there's no pain, no sadness. There's a lot of teachings behind that story that we only share at his celebration of life. But he's going towards a very beautiful place, and we believe that he'll see all of his ancestors and his beloved. He loved dogs too, and kids, but dogs especially. We had a dog named Nietzsche that he loved, that was passed on to my aunt, that she took care of after he started getting a little more immobile. And so I think that he will be very happy to see his beloved dog Nietzsche.
And why am I here?
Why am I here? He was here for many reasons, but I think it all comes back to educating. I think he did a lot of educating. He also was here for our family a lot, too. He showed us, especially the younger people in our family, how to be really beautiful and powerful leaders. He always taught us that through a lot of humor with us, a lot of teasing and telling you to go do these things, either in ceremony or at family dinners. He'd tell us to go and get him some water or something. So he always instilled like these teachings of love and caring within us. But as for Canada, I feel like he was put here to give a lot of himself to our people, and to showing us a brighter future towards reconciliation, showing us a pathway, giving us direction, I feel is one of his gifts that he gave us.
Yeah, a beautiful gift. Mm-hmm. And finally, this is a big one. Who am I?
He was so many things. But the way that I knew him, first of all, was the guy who dressed up as Shrek for Halloween.
I love picturing that in my head.
Yeah. So I knew him in that way, and full of humor. But I also know that he was a powerful leader for Indigenous people in our community. He was an educator, he was a judge and a lawyer that always tried to advocate for a more equitable system. He was a son, he was He was an uncle to so many people within ceremony and outside of ceremony. He was a father. He was an amazing grandfather, an amazing mushum, full of love and always full of, I just keep coming back to the laughter because that's always how I knew him. The foundation of who he is love and kindness and a lot of courage too.
This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. We'll talk more with Sarah Fontaine Sinclair later in the show. She is the granddaughter of the late Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair. He passed away in November at 73 years old. In 2009, Murray made a decision that would change his life, the lives of tens of thousands of Indigenous people, and lay a new path for Canada. He, along with Wilton Littlechild and Marie Wilson, were appointed to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. They spent 6 years traveling across the country, hearing and documenting the experiences of residential school survivors. Here's what he said to me back in 2021 about what carried him through that time.
The love of the survivors. They helped me get through it. It was, I don't think I could have gotten through it. I was reminding people that I turned down the opportunity to chair the TRC when it was first asked of me back in 2007, 2008, because I had just completed the inquiry into the deaths of babies at the Health Sciences Center. And I found that to be an emotionally difficult experience, and it stayed with me for a long time, longer than I thought it would. You know, I'm a pretty strong guy spiritually and emotionally, but you know, you can't help but think of mother's empty arms when every once in a while I would actually run into and meet one of the mothers who lost a baby to that surgical program. It would trigger me, and so I thought, you know, I can't go through this again, and so I turned it down. But when I was contemplating that decision, the other commissioners had a breakdown in their relationship, and the survivors, I was more concerned about the impact of that failure of the commission to get off the ground on the survivors, and I saw that the survivors were terribly negatively impacted. They saw it as a failure, that they were being re-victimized by the failure of the TRC to get off the ground. And so I was asked again if I would reconsider my decision not to chair, and I said, yes, I will, but I have conditions. And I imposed those conditions, and they honored them. But even then, sitting every day and listening to stories of survivors, again, you can have an 88-year-old guy sitting in front of you, and he's crying his eyes out because of what happened to him at residential school, and you can't help but think of him as a little boy, you know, just a little, you know, 3, 4, 5-year-old boy, and this was being done to him. And so we would have to take breaks and allow ourselves a moment to gather our thoughts and our emotions. They all said, we need you to finish this. And it was their love that carried me through it.
That's from a conversation I had with the Honorable Justice Murray Sinclair back in 2021 on the back porch of his country home. The TRC's work was heartbreaking and heavy, but Murray carried it with care. Someone who walked alongside him through that time is Stephanie Scott. Stephanie worked with the TRC gathering testimonies from survivors and was also Murray's executive assistant. She is now the executive director of the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. Stephanie, welcome to Unreserved.
Bonjour. Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
We just heard Murray speaking about how emotional the TRC's work was. How would you describe him during those years of traveling across the country to collect, you know, those precious stories of our residential school survivors?
During that time at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Murray Sinclair, along with Marie Wilson and Chief Wilton Littlechild heard from thousands upon thousands of survivors across the country. When he talks about the survivors coming and carrying them through with love, that's truly what I saw, because there was always an expression, a hug, laughter, there was teasing, and the laughter was medicine to support everyone that was involved in carrying that work forward. And I think as a leader, Honorable Sinclair, he asked himself once, you know, was I the right commissioner to do that work? And I absolutely believe that, because there was no other person that I could think of at this point in time that could have done that work, made it a success, provided the safety, took the care of all the survivors, and still respectfully cared for his family at the same time and brought them into the circle too. So when he would leave, you know, at the end of a national event, a private statement gathering opportunity, he would go home to them. And, you know, I know that it was also difficult, not only for him, but the family as well. And together, they all survived that experience and came through very powerful. During that time, I witnessed ceremony that was always important and integral to the care and wellness of everyone. And I really am a better person for being able to have walked beside him for, you know, a few years that I was his executive assistant at that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And as you walked, you know, beside him, how did you see Murray handle the weight of all of that work?
You know, for those that have had a personal connection to his honor, or for those that have seen him as this iconic figure in Canada and the world, he's also very human. And although he had his traditions and support, there were tears. You know, there were moments of silence. There were times that he would be staying awake, you know, after hours in his office and just giving everything that he could and, you know, pulling together research and reading the report and making edits and listening to survivor statements in order to ensure that, you know, those human rights violations never again happen to children. And when he speaks about the children, when he did have those 70 and 80 year old people coming, he would sit and he would listen. And even when the event was over, if there was a granny or a grandpa or an auntie or an uncle that came to him and wanted to share or just ask his advice, whether it was legal, personal, he sat and he took the time. And that was really incredible, because one of my colleagues says there's nothing better than the gift of time. And he did share that.
And as his executive assistant, you know, you got to see him in his work habits really up close. Was he an organized man or was he a messy man?
So Honorable Sinclair had an incredible, brilliant mind, as we all know. He also had what I witnessed is as a photographic memory in nature, as you would say. So when I first started working with him, I, you know, went into his office and he had thousands upon thousands of research and files and stacks. And, you know, he would often ask me to help him organize his research, specific files. And he would just sit there and I'd be talking, you know, where am I going to find this? How am I going to do this? And he would just say, just hang on a second. And he would close his eyes and he would like literally wave his finger. And then he would direct me to this pile of thousands of pages on his desk. And that file would be exactly where it was. And I always stood in awe of that, because I thought, wow, what an ability to harness all of the information. An avid reader. He worked very late into the night. And when we were at his ceremony, I spoke about, you know, I would come into his office and he would be sitting there and he'd be resting sometimes. And I knew that mission was alive and well in him. And I'd have to gently nudge him and say, Your Honor, you know, it's 8, it's 9 o'clock, it's time to go home. Because I knew that he was on this, I'll say, a horrendous schedule of travel right across the country, day in and day out. And for anyone that does that type of work, it's taxing. But he was determined, and I think he did an excellent job as head of the commission.
And I did say as well at at the end of the TRC report that we will not achieve reconciliation in my lifetime. We may not even achieve it in the lifetime of my grandchildren. But if we make a concerted effort, and that includes changing laws, changing the way that we govern, changing the way that we relate to Indigenous people as on a government-to-government basis, then eventually we will be able someday to wake up and, to our surprise, find that we are treating each other in a way that was intended when contact was first made.
Now, that made me a little sad, to be honest, Steph, to hear that I probably won't see reconciliation, and maybe my children won't see reconciliation, and it won't happen until they have children. How do you feel about it? How do you carry this work on, knowing that it may take beyond your lifetime to achieve?
I think that I continue this work because I am also a mother and a grandmother and a partner. The NCTR has 4 million records. We talk a lot about missing children and helping to find the missing and disappeared children find their ways home, which is a lot of the work that we're doing now. But there are handwritten letters in those archives from families writing to the administrators saying, "How dare you bury my child without telling me? You know, I want to take my second child out because I'm afraid that he's not going to make it home if I leave him there." And this is in cursive writing, and it's there in black and white. So when I think about the work that needs to happen, that's the driver for me. So until me, as an Indigenous woman in this country, feels safe that I can walk the streets and not be victimized, and I don't consider myself a victim, but until I don't have to feel afraid, until I can walk into a store and see myself represented and that I'm not being followed because they're thinking I'm going to shoplift no matter, you know, what I'm in there for. Once I see myself reflected in this country on the other side, that's going to be my driver. And that's going to be my future to ensure that it's better for my grandchildren. And those are some of the teachings that Murray said. Start with the children. Work with the children. They have open minds. They're ready to learn. They're ready to listen. That really is my hope and vision as to how we move forward on behalf of all survivors.
Thank you so much, Stephanie, for remembering Murray with me.
Thank you.
Stephanie Scott is the executive director of the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Let's get back to my conversation with Sarah Fontaine Sinclair. At your Mushum's Memorial Service on November 10th here in Winnipeg, your dad, Negan Sinclair, spoke very emotionally about his father and your Mushum as a poet, an artist, an educator. What can you tell us about those more artistic parts of his life?
When I was younger, he was always carving when he was less busy. He would always be very proud of his carvings. He took me down to his studio a lot and showed me like how to sand the wood. He was a very big carpenter. I remember this one carving that he had in his kitchen that he was always super proud of, but that was a little hidden away because my cook'em didn't like it as much. He's Fish Clan, Rainbow Trout Clan specifically, and my cook'em is Bear Clan, or was Bear Clan. And he had this carving in his kitchen of a fish biting a bear, like a bear's butt.
And must have been a big fish.
It was a small fish, but very mighty. Like, it was like dangling in the air, biting the bear. It was very funny.
That does sound very much like Murray.
Yeah.
You also spoke at that service. How did you decide, you know, what stories you were going to share with people across Turtle Island who attended the service or who were listening, streaming online?
I remember me and my dad were writing our speeches in a coffee shop next to each other. And it took me a while to decide what I wanted to write about. My dad knew right away. He always knows right away. But I took a little while. I was listening to some AC/DC, remembering him, and I was thinking about how a lot of people are going to be sharing about his role as a leader of Canada of the TRC, of being a lawyer. But I wanted people to more see how amazing of a grandfather he was and how amazing of a family member he was. Because I don't think people saw that as much, because he did that a lot privately. He was very protective of all of us. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted people to see how much both love for Canada that he had, but also love for his grandchildren and love for his family and love for his children that he had.
When the Truth and Reconciliation, you know, Commission released its final report, its calls to action, that really kind of showed up that love that he had mm-hmm. for family, that love that he had for, you know, for people, for Indigenous people. How old were you then and what were you seeing and experiencing at that time?
I was still pretty young. I think I was about 8 or 9, maybe even 7, somewhere in between those ages. I grew up going to all of those TRC events. My parents made sure that I saw them. The only parts that they didn't show to me was when the survivors were telling their stories. So I grew up seeing my mushroom heading those TRC events, and I always felt a lot of pride and a lot of me wanting to be like that when I was older. Mm. So when the final TRC event happened, I was there. And I remember we were walking down a street in Quebec and we were going towards, I forget what building we were going towards, but we were going towards a building. And I didn't walk the whole way, so didn't my cousins didn't also, their other grandchildren. And we all hopped in a car for the last like 15 minutes of the walk. I remember being in that car with my cousins and with my Mushroom and Cookum, and just seeing how both prideful he was of his work, like as he was seeing all the people walking along in this parade, but also how tiring that journey was. It was very tiring for him doing that work. And I felt a lot of pride too. During the final event, there was this prayer that we had at the very beginning, and I got to finish off the end of that prayer. I had I said the little amen and all of that, which I'm really grateful for. I think that shows that he was very much thinking about the next generation.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. That's not a perspective, you know, many people would have, as you know, especially as a young child watching somebody in their family have to lead something so difficult and seeing the weight of that. Was that ever challenging for you and your family?
Mm. I think we definitely felt it. We didn't get as much time with him as I think we all wanted. But we all saw the importance of the work that he was doing. He was called to do that work, and that was what he wanted to do. All of our time with him was very sacred and special, and I feel really grateful that we were able to have that time with him, but that he was also able to have that time with the nation.
When you say he was called to the work, what does that mean, being called to work, mean to you?
His traditional name is Mazanagijik Iban, and that means the person who looks towards the sky and sees pictures in the sky. He envisioned a lot of progress that we could have as Canada towards reconciliation. And so his name, I feel like, dictated his role as a leader to envisioning a better Canada and a better future for the next generations.
So, Sarah, in terms of reconciliation, of course, we know that that was near and dear to your Mushroom's heart. But even he said that that's not going to be accomplished in our lifetime. How do you feel that you carry on that work?
I feel very called to do a lot of educating within. I did a lot of educating within my high school and advocating for other Indigenous students. And I do workshops with my dad too. I'll help him speak sometimes. And I feel that my role in advancing reconciliation is educating others and also breaking through maybe walls that we haven't been able to get through. I'm studying music in university. I play the flute. My Mushroom saw this too, but I find that music is a very powerful tool of bringing people together that may not have been brought together otherwise.
Hmm. Lots of public speakers in your family. Of course, we all know Negan and his writing and his public speaking and his organizing in community for missing and murdered Indigenous women, for, you know, all these movements. How did your Mushum support, you know, you and your family in doing that work?
He always encouraged us to speak in front of others, especially in ceremony. He encouraged us all to be leaders and to share our own family teachings within ceremony. But for me specifically, I used to do concours d'oratoire, and it was like a French-speaking competition that you would do, and you'd write a whole speech out that you'd have to memorize. And my Mushum knew French because he had to learn it when he was doing legal work. And so he would always listen to my French speeches, and he'd correct some of the grammar, and he'd teach me over the phone usually, because he was always traveling to different places, about like where to look. He always told me to, when I'm public speaking, to divide the crowd into like three sections and to look at the crowd in that way, and to always lead with humor. He would always tell me to tell a joke at the beginning of a speech, because that's how you get people relaxed. His favorite is like, I know that I'm the one holding you back from the bathroom. That was his favorite one. But he would empower me to do a lot of public speaking. And concours d'oratoire is really where I started that public speaking journey. So he's very foundational in that for me.
Why do you think it was important for him that you and your family were so involved in community in that way?
It goes along a lot of our teachings and ceremony. Community is very important because we believe that everyone in a community has an important role to play in educating our community and also in leadership too. I think that us being involved with the community was really important because he saw a lot of injustices in our community, especially within Winnipeg. And I think that he wanted to ensure that we would take on that work when we were older.
Really wanted to uplift and really heal the community.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly it. I think he wanted us to see the injustices that I said in our community, and then to make sure that we could carry on his work in the future.
And finally, Sarah, what do you think your Mushum's legacy will be, you know, as a treasure of this nation and as your Mushum?
I think that he was a very important person in Canada. He will be known, I think, for many generations for the work that he's done. I think that his legacy will be rooted a lot in his way of giving us a path forward towards reconciliation. I think the country was really lost for a long time about, you know, how we can move forward and what we can do to be better Canadian citizens and to be able to be better for each other, to be more empathetic towards each other. And he really gave us a path that we can follow to be able to lead ourselves toward reconciliation. And I hope that his legacy will be seen with a lot of love too. He led with a lot of love throughout his entire life, and I hope that people see that kindness and love that he always led with.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sarah Fontaine Sinclair is the granddaughter of Murray Sinclair. She is Anishinaabe and Cree and currently a music student at the University of Ottawa. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, and Bridget Stringer-Holden. The clips of Murray Sinclair you heard today were from the CBC News Archives. A special thanks to The Next Chapter and The Current for sharing some of their Murray moments with us. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Then ask him it now, I will say.